Welcome to No Strings Attached. Our episode today is a deep dive into what it took to send emergency cash to over 2,500 Jamaicans after Hurricane Melissa hit the island in late October. I'm sitting down with Leith Baker and Camille Ragon from GiveDirectly's emergency response team to learn more. Leith, thanks for being here. For starters, why is cash useful after a storm? What are its advantages after something like Melissa hits Jamaica over other types of aid?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Tyler. Great to be here. It gives people flexibility. Right? Like it's hard for us to predict exactly what each individual is going to need, what the priority is going to be for them and their family. Maybe they need a roof. Maybe they need access to clean water. Maybe they need food. Maybe they need a little bit of all those things. And cash gives them the flexibility to work that out and to address their own priorities. It's also a lot lighter and more efficient to deliver, right? There's no big trucks. There's no big warehouses. You know, we're not landing planes or ships full of commodities. We can move it digitally. So it's light and quick and efficient to get into people's hands. So those two things together are hugely impactful.
And tell us more about this storm, because it's very serious, but of course we're assuming that people can use the money to buy things they need. So how does that balance out?
Yeah, this was the biggest storm to ever hit Jamaica. It was a Category 5. It set some records in terms of pressure and the other metrics of storms. So incredible event for Jamaica. It was also very localized within Jamaica. So it wasn't like the whole island was affected. The capital was relatively unscathed. And so, you know, one of our first questions landing is like, well, what's the status of markets? If we give people money, can they buy things? And it was very clear very early that while the direct impacted area of the hurricane, those markets were devastated, you know, warehouses destroyed and things like that, there were goods coming in from other parts of the island almost immediately. In fact, in the first day when we got on the ground, kind of in St. Elizabeth in the impacted area, we saw people selling stuff out of the back of their cars and, you know, selling solar radios and solar phone chargers and things like that they'd brought in from the capital, and food commodities and things like that were available because the rest of the island was okay and the markets were up and running. So that gave us a lot of confidence that cash was going to be the right answer in this moment.
So we have a couple of recordings of Jamaicans who received GiveDirectly cash aid after the storm. They're speaking in Jamaican patois, so we're going to play a bit of the audio, but then it would be great to hear from each of you about what these stories are about. First from Désolé, he is in St. Elizabeth Parish, Jamaica. Leith, walk us through what he's telling us. No tree.
Sure enough. So Désolé is telling a story that we heard a lot when we were going and meeting with people in St. Elizabeth, Jamaica, where he's talking about how when the storm hit, they went into the center of their house to try to find the kind of the safest part of the house, and then just felt the house being disassembled around them. And so he talks about how he's bringing the mattress into the hallway and bringing, you know, their papers and their valuables into the hallway and all holding each other as the house, the roof comes off, the walls come off, all around them. I heard this story several times, and it was terrifying every time. And then he's talking about how, you know, the money that he's received from GiveDirectly, the $650, he's going to use it to build a temporary home for his family to get them out of the elements while he resumes his livelihood and rebuilds the rest of his home. So it's a very powerful bit of audio and something that we encountered a lot while we were there.
And Camille, here we have Ivory, another one of the recipients. Could you tell us a bit about what she's sharing?
Is the counter that I use, sir?
Ivory unfortunately lost her livelihood during Hurricane Melissa. So she had chicken, she was running a shop where she was able to sell goods, but everything was destroyed. So the place where her shop was is completely destroyed. There's no walls that are even standing at this point. She's explaining that she's very happy to have received the $650 because this is going to help her restart her businesses. So she bought a cooler with some juices, and she's really going to start from there. She's invested in restarting her business, restarting her livelihood, which in turn will help her restart her life.
Thanks so much for sharing both of those. I actually wanted to take a step back to before the storm hit. What was going on for the GiveDirectly emergency response team as you're watching the news and seeing this storm tracking towards Jamaica?
It was a lot of uncertainty. You know, the storm, it was a peculiar storm, the way it was sort of moving around, changing direction. We knew a couple of days before it hit Jamaica that it was headed in that direction, but we didn't know exactly where on the island it was going to hit. And it intensified a lot right before. So there's a lot of uncertainty about kind of what was going to happen, how bad it was going to be, if it was going to be a direct hit, if it might just go by.
And once the storm makes landfall in Category 5, we're all watching the storm map on the news. What is actually happening for you on the emergency response team? How are you getting information after it's passed about where the damage is and what to do next?
Yeah. So we're looking at, you know, open source public information. We're watching the news like everybody else is. But we're also trying to make contact with folks, you know, on the island in the area. So I was making calls around to hotels and things like that that were in the area affected. As you might guess, you know, power was out, cell towers were down and out. So there wasn't, it was really tough to get information from the impacted area. So we were pretty blind even as we were starting to plan, put somebody in motion.
Did you get in touch with any of those hotels? What were those calls like when you actually
got did. I got through to one. There was a hotel. They had a generator and they had a Starlink. And so they had comms. I was able to get through to them on WhatsApp. And it was really the only contact that we had before we left of anyone in the impacted area. They actually invited us to come and sort of stay. They had a compound and they were emptying their freezers out into a soup kitchen to try and feed their staff and the families of their staff and people in the community. And so they invited us to come and kind of work out of their area for the first couple of days.
Cool. What's that hotel? We got to shout them out.
Blue Fields. Let me look it up.
All right, we'll look it up. We'll put it in the credits. Book your Jamaican hotel vacation stay at this place. Okay, so the storm makes landfall on Tuesday. By Friday morning, you're on an airplane. What's the flight down like?
So the airlines had put extra flights on because there were so many tourists stranded to come out. And so the flight itself was actually pretty empty, except for other relief workers trying to get in. So, you know, it was like a third full or less because there were all these folks stranded. They were using those planes to bring people out.
I see. And so when you get there on Friday, we know we're going to get cash out to Jamaicans. We've started fundraising for this, but we don't actually have any idea who will pay, how we'll pay them, or even what area to work in. And you hit the island on Friday with some support team. What are you start doing to figure out how to build a program?
Yeah, no, there was a lot of unknowns. In fact, I flew in with full camping gear, tent, water treatment, food for 3 days, ready to be kind of completely self-sufficient. You know, certainly didn't want to be a burden on anyone in this impacted area. You know, when I landed, we had some priorities. First, we're trying to work out where was the impacted area and was it and how did it affect the rest of the country? Was the capital still operational? Could we get vehicles? Was there going to be a hotel that we could work out of that might be closer to the affected area? Did we need to be right in the area that was impacted by the storm or could we be just outside? So we're looking at kind of how to set up a forward operating base. We were looking at how people get money into Jamaica. You know, that was a big question. How do the people of Jamaica transfer money amongst themselves? That we knew that Jamaica has a huge diaspora with a lot of remittances, folks working overseas who are sending money back to Jamaica. So we presumed that there were certain channels for sending that money that we could piggyback on that would be familiar to folks and that would work. So we were trying to understand, you know, those dynamics. And then, you know, one of the big questions was, you know, we certainly weren't going to have enough resources to help everyone. And so we needed to work out how to prioritize who to send the limited funds that we had to. So those were our big questions going in.
So a lot of us on the news had seen Black River, which is where the storm made landfall and is a township at the coast. And that was where a lot of the news crews were. When you went there, what were some of the first things you saw in that region? What struck you about the devastation of this storm?
Just the, you know, the sheer sort of physical manifestation of the power of the storm. You know, we saw telephone poles just snapped like toothpicks, kind of 8 feet in the air, just snapped over. You know, in around Black River and the places that really took the brunt of it, you saw, you know, just cement platforms where the whole house was gone. You know, everything was just completely gone. And then, you know, out from there, you'd see varying degrees of destruction, but just lots and lots of roofs gone, a lot of damage to houses.
What were those first conversations with the communities like? You know, what were the things that people needed and what was on their mind in the medium and long term?
Well, it's interesting. So that Saturday, so I arrived on Friday and Saturday morning, the first thing I did was drive to the very edge of the impacted area, which was about 2.5 hours from the capital, to the Western Union. So Western Union is a money transfer service that is very common in Jamaica. And we suspected it was going to be the easiest way, the most familiar way that we could send money to folks in Jamaica. They had an office. So this was the office like right on the edge of the area that was affected. And so I went there and they had a 3-hour line. They just opened after the storm. It was the first sort of morning they were open and there was a 3-hour line out the door, folks just trying to get money so that they could get back and bring some supplies back to their homes in St. Elizabeth, the parish where Black River is. So you know, it was very affirming that kind of folks were looking for financial resources to try and get back on their feet after this storm.
What's the scene like as far as the other sort of aid groups that are there? Who's on the ground, and are there other folks who are also delivering cash? What's it like to be operating in that world?
So World Century Kitchen was very present. One of the real interesting things, there was actually a traffic challenge getting into the affected area because of vehicles from the capital, just the Jamaican community, sending supplies and going out to check on friends and relatives and stuff like that. So it was a tremendous outpouring of support from across Jamaica in the first few days of folks sending materials from the capital. In terms of cash, we were the only actor kind of looking at that in the early days. Kind of a week to 10 days in, there was the cash working group was established, which was, you know, a formal kind of coordination mechanism run by the UN to support coordinated assistance. They are still, to my knowledge, kind of 5 weeks in, or wherever we are, they're still kind of getting organized to do some of the first United Nations cash.
I think there's something really interesting there, which is GiveDirectly. We got cash out to families about 2 weeks after the storm, which would be the fastest group getting cash to people. And we're sending these payments. So could you tell us a little bit about the design that you landed on in the end? So you did a lot of assessment, but mm-hmm. How much were people getting? How were they even getting signed up? How did you get to some of those decisions?
Yeah, that's great. So one of the first questions was, how much money should we send folks? And so we were looking at a number of inputs. First, there'd been big storms that had hit Jamaica in the past, and so we had evidence from past cash assistance to see what folks had given in the past. We were also looking at, you know, we wanted to meet people's basic needs, but we also wanted to kind of get them on the road to rebuilding their house or reestablishing their livelihoods or that sort of thing. But we also had limited resources, so we weren't going to be able to rebuild somebody's house entirely or anything like that. And so when we looked at it all, we ended up at $650 per recipient. And that was larger than previous cash assistance in Jamaica after storms. But we felt it would allow people to kind of meet their basic needs, kind of get some clean water, get some food, get themselves sorted out in the immediate moment and start to look to the future. So we felt really good about that. And it kind of balanced with the resources that we had to hand.
You mentioned that GiveDirectly was the first cash group to send payments, and others are still working on setting those payments up. Why is it that GiveDirectly is able to sort of get cash to people faster and overcome some of those obstacles that might be friction points for other aid groups?
Yeah, one of it is in the design that we chose. So we decided to prioritize communities that were in poverty that had been highly impacted by the storm. So rather than try and identify the kind of personally most impacted people or the personally most vulnerable people in the community or in the whole impacted area, we looked for sort of subpopulations that were geographically distinct. So a village here, a community there, and then would enroll, kind of would determine that everyone who was in that community was eligible. And that allowed us to sort of shortcut a lot of the door-to-door kind of vulnerability assessments that we might find in other programs and other contexts. We also did a very digital first kind of design where we set up a process where applicants could essentially apply for assistance. So they would self-enroll. We had a web form. We would put out flyers with a QR code that would lead them to the web form. And they would just fill it out and say, hey, you know, I'm from this place. Here's a photo of my ID. Here's why I think I'm eligible. And then we would on the back and be able to determine from those applications who fit our criteria and who didn't. And that allowed us to very quickly create a list of folks that met the criteria, which was mostly about geography, where we'd pick these communities that were poor and impacted by the storm.
Great. I think what's really interesting there to me is part of what lets us move fast is the same thing that keeps us kind of efficient in our poverty relief programs in Africa, which is you enroll an entire community that you know is vulnerable, and you get to cut down all that time spent picking and choosing the in-group and the out-group from the aid. Everybody can get it if they can prove that they're eligible.
Absolutely. And we've got a lot of learning about that from our poverty programs, about the kind of the second order benefits, right? Of, you know, when you fund a whole community, it lifts up markets, it has all these extra benefits. That's a hypothesis we also have in these humanitarian contexts. We haven't done that research yet, but we're excited to see what that looks like in these kinds of contexts also.
Great. I'd love to now switch over to speaking to Camille. So for those listening, Camille basically comes to the island after Leith is done with this initial assessment and has to now like make the program that her manager came up with actually happen. And so my first question for you, Camille, is what were all the things that Leith was wrong about when you first showed up? What were the assumptions that didn't work? What was broken when you had to start building it?
I think the main assumption that we made is that most people would be in shelters and that would be a quote unquote easy spot for us to reach a large number of recipients. Well, it turns out no one was there. So I think we only had one shelter with a significant amount of people, and that was a school in middle quarters. But most of the shelters were pretty much empty. And we had to kind of shift our operational model to going around in the communities, in shops, in various points to find the recipients and do in-person sensitization, which means telling people about the program, about GiveDirectly, how they can enroll, and yeah, just be there to answer any questions.
And could you take me through from the perspective of a recipient enrolling, what would I be doing? What would I see? How would I get signed up? How would I get the money?
Sure. So there's two ways for them to find out about our program. The first one was, as Leith was explaining, we were putting up posters with QR code and recipients could go and enroll themselves or through those in-person sensitization. So once the recipient knew about our program, they could take their smartphone. They would either scan the QR code or use the web link that was on the form, and that would take them to a questionnaire. Then they just have to answer a couple of questions, where they're from, which parish they're from, for example, provide their name, consent, of course, if they accept to be part of the program, take photos of their IDs, and then, yeah, they basically submit the form, and then we receive the information that they've inputted.
Great. And keep taking me through. After they've inputted it, how does it keep working for me to get the money, and how do I find out and then go get it?
Yeah. So once you finish enrolling yourself and you've submitted the form, we from the back office would do some verification. If the person is eligible, they get an SMS or WhatsApp saying, yes, you're eligible to participate in the program. You get a code. You can go to Western Union, and then you can cash out your money.
It sounds like a very simple system. So you get the word out, people self-enroll, then they get a notification to go to the bank or the Western Union, get their money, voila. But that's not quite what happened, right? Things sort of started to break, things started slowly. Could you talk to me about the obstacles that came up when you first launched?
Sure. So the amount of money we were able to send to Western Union was only $7,000. $7,000 is about 10 recipients. So that is really not at all the amount of people that we were aiming to reach per day. So we had to negotiate with them to be able to increase to $200,000 and then even more to $400,000 when we were really sending batch payments. One of the other obstacles is we thought that our form was going to go viral. So we kept an enrollment window of 3 days to give people a bit of time to find some connectivity and enroll. By the end of the 3 days, I think we had around only like 200 enrollments, which was not at all the numbers that we were aiming for. So we had to do more in-person sensitization, spending like 3 to 4 days in the different communities, speaking with different people, speaking to shop owners to make sure that people knew about our program. And then it's once we paid the first recipients that we suddenly went completely viral. And our numbers went from like daily enrollments of like 100 to 200 people to like thousands of recipients enrolling every day.
So it sounds like it's sort of a seeing is believing. Like you're just this group walking around telling people, trust us, we're going to send money. And people are managing a lot after the storm. But once people start walking back from that Western Union, like with cash in hand, then suddenly everybody sees this is a real program from a real group.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. And I know also, you know, language was a bit of a barrier. A lot of English is spoken, but also a lot of Patois, which is different. How did you accommodate that when launching both the program, the form, and also call centers?
Yeah, so what was really interesting is that we had an assumption that we had to translate all of our material to Jamaican Patois. So we used Google Translate to translate them into Patois. And then I went to the hotel lobby and I was like, could you please just have a look and let me know if this makes sense. And then the woman at the reception was like, spending a really long time reading three messages And then she looked at me and she was like, "Well, you know what? We never actually write in Jamaican patois. We just translate what we see in English, and then it goes into our heads in Jamaican patois. So I really don't think you need to translate anything." So that was a really interesting learning.
What are some of the things that people are spending on from when you were on the ground and the folks you've spoken to?
Yeah, so most people were talking to us about rebuilding their homes. So buying corrugated roofs, rebuying cement to put their houses together. Another thing was their livelihoods. So a lot of people wanted to buy some chickens to restart their small businesses. And of course, some of the basic needs like food and water.
That's great. And so, what has been the impact so far? How many people have we sent cash to, and what's the plan for the future?
So we've managed to reach until now 2,534 people. That's $1.6 million sent to communities in Jamaica. Our aim is to reach around 2,700 recipients, and this we'll be managing to do in the next couple of weeks. After that, we will do a follow-up, and the purpose of this is for us to learn and ensure that we do better in future responses. Another thing that we're trying to do in January is doing a more in-depth qualitative research. So the idea is to have someone that goes back to Jamaica that speaks in person to some recipients, but also other key people in the communities to try to have a more in-depth understanding of what was the impact of the program.
Great. And zooming out for a second, I want to just get Leith back in here. A lot of people think about GiveDirectly as an organization that sends $1,000 to families in extreme poverty in East Africa. Why are we doing this sort of emergency response work as well? What's the idea behind running programs like Jamaica in a wealthier country that's better resourced than the places we usually work?
It's a great question, Tyler. These folks were severely impacted. You know, they had their whole lives upended. So Jamaica for sure is a middle-income country with a government with a lot of capacity. But the folks that we met were having the worst day of their life, you know, after that storm where they'd absolutely lost everything. We saw people standing next to their homes, really at a loss of figuring out what to do. And that's real. And those folks need help also. So we're ready to kind of meet the needs of folks wherever they are. We're also looking in some of these responses to learn and test our tools. And so one of the things that we came out of the Jamaica response with is a lot of learning about the kind of the back-end technology that we can use to move quickly. We validated some ways of working around self-enrollment and things like that that we can certainly take to other less resourced environments. So it was an opportunity for us to test a lot of technology that we then want to deploy in other places. One thing that I might highlight that we wanted to test and did was the use of Starlink. So you know, the telecom infrastructure was destroyed by the storm, but it was coming back. But we were able to use Starlink's mobile internet service to set up hotspots. And so people would enroll using our hotspot, and then they would receive the SMS with the telco via the cell tower a couple of days later as service came back on. But that allowed us to kind of get enrollment going in advance of the resumption of cell tower service. So that worked out really well, and it's something we want to look at for the future.
Great. So it sounds like, of course, the need is very high, but also the things that we're learning in these rapid and iterative responses helps inform all of GiveDirectly's work, and that builds muscle, and a lot of our biggest breakthroughs
Absolutely.
Historically have come from this. And with that in mind, we'd love to hear from each of you the one thing from this response that's most exciting to bring forward in the future, and one thing you learned that didn't work that well. We can start with you, Leith.
Sure. I think one of the things that we're excited about is that I'm most excited about is that self-enrollment. This idea that, you know, if we've got a population that has cell phones, we're confident that there's high kind of ownership of cell phones, that folks can self-enroll if we can create the connectivity opportunity. We were uncertain about that, as Camille explained, kind of in the early days, it wasn't clear it was going to work, and then it did. That's huge. And I think that's going to unlock a lot of speed and efficiency, right? Because it's a very low-cost way to identify folks and get them resources.
Great. And one thing that you learned for next time.
So as fast as we were, we probably could have been faster. We could have deployed before the storm. You know, it was clear a couple of days before that it was headed towards Jamaica, not clear exactly where. You know, I think we probably could have gotten there right before the storm. And as we build our team and kind of build our capacity, I think, you know, that's the sort of thing we're going to want to be doing.
Great. Same question for you, Camille. Most exciting, something you learned.
So in terms of something that I learned that's going to be important in the future is having the capacity to target the right people and to ingest the data and the information that we get at the onset of a response. We just receive so much information from different organizations, from the governments, from NGOs, from the United Nations, and having people that can understand this data and put it into simple words and help us identify where we can be the most valuable is key. Fortunately, we have now these people on board, and I think it's going to be great working with them in future responses.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this background information on how we were able to deliver people's donations to Jamaicans in need.
This has been No Strings Attached, a podcast from GiveDirectly. If you want to support our future emergency cash programs, you can go to givedirectly.org/relief.
And you can give funds so that they're pre-positioned, so that we have them ready to deliver right when the next crisis hits.
If you want to support that hotel that Leith mentioned for your vacation to Jamaica, let's give them some love. They're called Blue Fields Villas, and the link is also in the show notes.
If you want to watch Desolée and Ivory stories on video with subtitles, you can find those at givedirectly.org/Jamaica, along with other information about this response.
This has been No Strings Attached, a podcast from GiveDirectly, hosted by me, Tyler G. Hall, and produced by Mary Blair. You can learn more at givedirectly.org.